This CLE is based on the New York State appellate decisions addressing issues in criminal law that were released in February of 2020. Selected decisions were summarized on the website, New York Appellate Digest, and those summaries from February 2020 have been compiled into the February 2020 Criminal Law Update pamphlet. That pamphlet serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is People v. Wheeler on page 6. It's a Court of Appeals case dealing with the jurisdictional dealing with a jurisdictional defect in an information. The Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate term, held the accusatory instrument, which was an information, charging defendant with obstructing government administration, was jurisdictionally defective because it did not include factual allegations of the official function alleged to have been obstructed. The court wrote, defendant was convicted of obstructing governmental administration in the second degree for backing his vehicle away from police officers who were attempting to execute a warrant to search the vehicle. With regard to the official function element of the obstruction charge, the accusatory instrument lacked factual allegations providing defendant with notice of the official function with which he was charged with interfering, namely a police stop of defendant in his vehicle in order to execute a search warrant, citing Penal Law Section 195.05. Defendant therefore lacked sufficient notice to prepare his defense, rendering the information jurisdictionally defective. Next is People v. Slade on page 8. It deals with a waiver of appeal, which was found to be invalid. Second Department held defendant's waiver of appeal was not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently made. Executing a written waiver does not fix a deficient colloquy. The court wrote, a defendant should receive an explanation of the nature of the right to appeal, which essentially advises that this right entails the opportunity to argue before a higher court any issues pertaining to the defendant's conviction and sentence, and to have that higher court decide whether the conviction or sentence should be set aside based upon any of those issues, and that appellate counsel will be appointed in the event that he or she were indigent. The criminal jury instructions and model colloquies available online through the New York State Unified Court System's website include a model colloquy for the waiver of the right to appeal. While the use of the model colloquy is not mandatory, its use may nevertheless substantially reduce the difficulties provided that the trial judges retain and use flexibility to undertake individualized inquiries as appropriate. The county court's terse colloquy during the plea allocution failed to sufficiently advise the defendant of the nature of his right to appeal and the consequences of waiving that right. Although the defendant executed a written appeal waiver form, a written waiver is not a complete substitute for an on-the-record explanation of the nature of the right to appeal. Moreover, the defendant was not informed of the maximum sentence that could be imposed if he failed to comply with the conditions of his plea agreement. Thus, the purported appeal waiver does not preclude appellate review of the defendant's contention that the enhanced sentence was excessive. Next is People v. Fraser on pages 9 and 10. It deals with several issues, but the main issue here was whether the court properly reopened the suppression hearing to allow the people to present more evidence. The First Department held the suppression hearing was properly reopened to allow the people to present additional testimony. The court wrote, while testimony established the requisite probable cause to arrest defendant, the court providently exercised its discretion in granting the people's motion to reopen the suppression hearing before rendering a decision in order to permit the people to call an officer with additional information tending to establish reasonable suspicion. The court had not made any ruling and the circumstances did not pose a risk of tailored testimony. Upon granting the people's motion to present additional evidence, the court expressly stated that it had not yet rendered a decision. Despite defendants' arguments to the contrary, there's nothing in the hearing transcript to suggest that the court previously forecasted its decision or provided guidance to the people. The court's very brief remark at the end of the initial hearing about an aspect of the facts cannot be viewed as a direction from the court and was highly unlikely to result in tailored testimony. Next is People v. Ramirez on pages 10 and 11. It has two issues, prosecutorial misconduct and irrelevant Molyneux evidence. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction in this gang assault case, held that prosecutorial misconduct and the admission of irrelevant evidence of another crime required reversal. The court wrote, "On summation, a prosecutor may not improperly encourage inferences of guilt based on facts not in evidence. As we determined in People v. Ramirez, the prosecutor here improperly suggested that the jury should disregard the grand jury testimony of one of the people's main witnesses and invited the jury to speculate that a missing witness would have given supporting testimony if he had been called to testify." Turning to the Molyneux issue, the court wrote, "The rule of Molyneux is familiar. Evidence of uncharged crimes is inadmissible where its only purpose is to show bad character or propensity towards crime. However, evidence of other crimes may be admitted to show motive, intent, the absence of mistake or accident, a common scheme or plan, or the identity of the guilty party. In addition, evidence of uncharged crimes may be admitted as necessary background material when relevant to a contested issue in the case, or to complete the narrative of the events if such evidence is inextricably interwoven with the crime charged. The fact that the defendant allegedly resisted arrest 6 months after the incident in question after violating an order of protection against him held by one of the complainants was not relevant in this matter. The defendant was not resisting arrest for the crimes charged at trial, and resisting arrest in this instance was too far removed from the underlying incident to be deemed admissible as evidence of consciousness of guilt." Next is People v. Favors, which is on page 11. It deals with the defense attorney's role and the defendant's role, in this case with respect to the decision to admit or deny allegations in a predicate felony statement. The Fourth Department noted that the decision whether to admit or deny the allegations in a predicate felony statement is reserved to the defendant personally, not defense counsel. The court wrote, "Whether to admit or controvert the allegations in a predicate felony statement is a fundamental decision, comparable to how to plead and whether to waive a jury, take the stand, or appeal, and it is therefore reserved to the accused personally. Thus, the court did not violate defendant's right to counsel by accepting his personal decision to controvert the allegations in the people's predicate felony statement, notwithstanding defense counsel's contrary views and advice." Next is People v. Brown on page 12. It deals with an application to delay discovery in a criminal matter pursuant to the Criminal Procedure Law, Section 245.70. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, granted the people's application for a protective order delaying release of discovery until 45 days before trial. The court wrote, "Pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law, 245.70 Subdivision 6, a party who has unsuccessfully sought or opposed the granting of a protective order relating to the name, address, contact information, or statements of a person may obtain expedited review by an individual justice of the intermediate appellate court to which an appeal from a judgment of conviction would be taken. Where, as here, The issue involves balancing the defendant's interest in obtaining information for defense purposes against concerns for witness safety and protection, the question appropriately framed as whether the determination made by the trial court was a provident exercise of discretion. I conclude that the Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in directing immediate disclosure of the subject materials to counsel for the defendant and the investigator. Under the particular facts and circumstances of this case, the Supreme Court should have delayed disclosure of the subject materials to counsel for the defendant and his investigator until 45 days before trial. Next is People v. Thelesmond, pages 13 and 14. It's an evidentiary issue dealing with the admissibility of a 911 call. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the recording of the 911 call was not admissible as an excited utterance or as a present sense impression. Court wrote, "The people did not present sufficient facts from which it could be inferred that the anonymous caller personally observed the incident. The anonymous caller merely stated to the 911 operator that somebody just got shot on East 19th and Albemarle, and that it was a guy with crutches. He started to shoot." Nothing in these brief, conclusory statements, which were made at least 5 minutes after the shooting, suggested that the caller was reporting something that he saw as opposed to something he was told. Moreover, although there was testimony that the call was made from a payphone located in the vicinity of the shooting, the people did not demonstrate that the payphone was situated outdoors or in a place where the actual site of the shooting would be visible. Accordingly, the statement did not qualify as an excited utterance. For similar reasons, the declarations of the 911 caller were not admissible under the present sense impression exception to the hearsay rule. Present sense impression declarations are descriptions of events made by a person who is perceiving the event as it is unfolding. Next is People v. Rivera, pages 14 and 15. It's another evidentiary issue. This time, the proof of the value of stolen property. The Second Department held the grand jury third degree conviction was against the weight of the evidence because the value of the stolen items was not proven. The court wrote, "The only evidence of the value of the stolen items was the complainant's testimony regarding the purchase price of some of those items, and he did not testify as to when he purchased those items, their market value, or the cost to replace them. Although a victim is competent to supply evidence of original cost, evidence of the original purchase price without more will not satisfy the people's burden. On this record, we cannot conclude that the fact finder could reasonably infer, rather than merely speculate, that the value of all the stolen goods exceeded the statutory threshold of $3,000. Next is People v. Devereaux on page 15, another evidentiary issue. Second Department held a revolver found by a passerby 7 blocks from the scene of the crime should not have been admitted in evidence, but it held that the error was harmless. The court wrote, "When real evidence is purported to be the actual object associated with a crime, the proof of accuracy has 2 elements. The offering party must establish, first, that the evidence is identical to that involved in the crime, and second, that it has not been tampered with. At trial, the only eyewitness at the scene of the shooting who observed the defendant armed with a firearm testified that the defendant was armed with a silver long barrel revolver. Contrary to the court's determination, although that testimony was somewhat consistent with the defendant's description of his revolver, it was insufficient to provide reasonable assurances that the revolver that was admitted into evidence was the same revolver used by the defendant during the shooting. No forensic evidence was recovered from the subject revolver linking it to the defendant, and more significantly, the eyewitness was never asked, either by the police after the revolver was recovered or by the prosecution at trial, to identify the revolver as the actual object used by the defendant during the shooting. Further, there was no evidence in the record to support the court's independent observation that the revolver that was admitted into evidence was very uncommon and a very, very unique gun. Next is People v. Manning. It's a case dealing with a four-cause challenge to a juror. It's on page 16. The First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the judge should not have granted the People's four-cause challenge to a selected but unsworn juror. Although the juror had an important out-of-town meeting on the day before the trial was to conclude, the record did not demonstrate the juror could not render an impartial verdict on that ground. The court wrote, "The record did not justify the court's discharge for cause of a selected but unsworn juror. Both defendant and the People initially declined to challenge the juror peremptorily or for cause. However, the prosecutor challenged the juror for cause over defense objection after the court, concerned about an important out-of-town meeting that the prospective juror was scheduled to attend on a day before the anticipated conclusion of the trial, announced that it would grant such a challenge. Although subsequent questioning demonstrated that rescheduling the meeting would be inconvenient for the juror, it did not establish that the juror, who never directly asked to be excused for hardship or otherwise, had a state of mind that was likely to preclude him from rendering an impartial verdict based on the evidence adduced at the trial. By way of contrast, in People v. Williams, 44 AD 3rd, 326, we found that the selected but unsworn juror at issue was unfit for service because her scheduling conflict involving a funeral would make it difficult for her to focus on the trial. Here, the juror's responses did not establish a sufficient reason to sustain a challenge for cause, which was the only issue presented to and ruled upon by the court." Next, People v. Anderson on page 17. It's a jury instruction case. Although the error was deemed harmless, the Second Department held the jury should not have been instructed on the combat by agreement exception to the justification defense. Defendant was on a bus when rival gang members got on the bus. The defendant, who was 14 years old, pulled out a gun and shot, killing an innocent passenger. The court wrote, "Supreme Court should not have charged the jury with respect to the combat by agreement exception to the justification defense." The court granted the People's request for the instruction based upon generalized evidence that the defendant was a member of a gang which had a rivalry with the other local gangs, including the gang with which the persons who approached the defendant were affiliated. However, any evidence of an alleged agreement in this case was tacit, open-ended as to time and place, and applicable to all members of the gangs of the parties involved, as well as to all members of their affiliate gangs. The combat by agreement exception to justification is generally limited to agreements to combat between specific individuals or groups on discrete occasions. Next is People v. Klug on page 18. The main issue here deals with a note from the jury. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the record does not indicate defense counsel was made aware of a juror's complaint to the judge about the deliberations and the contents of a note from the jury. The court wrote, "At the commencement of the second day of deliberations, the court met with counsel and deliberating juror C.H., who had left the court a telephone message expressing concerns about deliberations. This conversation took place outside the defendant's presence. Although the court properly attempted to keep its communication with C.H. ministerial by simply directing her to put her concerns in writing, C.H. refused to accept the court's directions, expressing concerns about the course of deliberations, including a concern that someone was stirring the jury and that other jurors had been influenced. The court eventually directed a court officer to return C.H. to the jury room and provide her with writing materials. After the colloquy with C.H. and following an off-the-record discussion, The defendant was returned to the courtroom, and the court stated that it had received a note from the jury which had been marked as Court Exhibit X and sealed with the consent of all parties. No further discussion of Court Exhibit X appears on the record. We cannot assume from the county court statement that the parties agreed to seal the note, that counsel was made aware of the exact contents of the note, since an insufficient record cannot be overcome with speculation about what might have occurred. The presumption of regularity cannot salvage an Orama error of this nature. Moreover, since the failure to disclose a jury note to counsel is a mode of proceedings error, it cannot be overlooked as harmless, even where the evidence is otherwise overwhelming. Next is People v. David T. on page 19. It has to do with determining a defendant's mental condition. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held it was reversible error to fail to conduct a hearing to determine defendant's mental condition after the defendant had been examined by two psychiatrists who concluded defendant suffered from a dangerous mental condition. The error was not preserved, but was reviewed in the interest of justice. The court wrote, Criminal Procedure Law, Section 330.20, Subdivision 6, provides that after the examination reports are submitted, the court must, within 10 days of the receipt of such reports, conduct an initial hearing to determine the defendant's present mental condition. In this case, however, the court did not conduct an initial hearing, and the defendant's conviction was reversed. Next is People v. Juan R. on page 20. It's another case involving a mental disorder. Second Department, reversing County Court, held defendant did not receive effective assistance of counsel because the attorney conceded defendant suffered from a dangerous mental disorder. County Court should have held the mandatory statutory hearing. The appeal is not academic because of the lasting effect of the finding defendant suffers from a dangerous mental disorder. The court wrote, The initial hearing under Criminal Procedure Law, Section 330.20, Subdivision 6, is a critical stage of the proceedings during which the defendant is entitled to the effective assistance of counsel. Here there was simply no legitimate strategy that could have warranted defense counsel's concession that the defendant suffered from a dangerous mental disorder, implicitly consenting to the defendant's confinement in a secure facility. As defense counsel failed to provide meaningful representation, the defendant was deprived of the effective assistance of counsel. Next is People v. Work on page 21. It deals with a sentencing issue and an appellate issue. The Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant was not eligible for a parole supervision sentence, and the court, defense counsel, and the prosecutor mistakenly believed defendant was eligible. Defendant's guilty plea was based upon the understanding the court would consider such a sentence, which the court ultimately did not impose. Because all parties misunderstood the law, defendant could not be expected to have preserved the error by moving to withdraw his plea, and the matter can therefore be considered on appeal. Next is People v. Anonymous on page 22, another sentencing case. The Court of Appeals held the sentencing court should not have considered the erroneously unsealed records of a prior criminal action which was terminated in favor of the defendant. The matter was sent back for resentencing. A court is without authority to consider for sentencing purposes erroneously unsealed official records of a prior criminal action or proceeding terminated in favor of the defendant. Where violation of the sealing mandate of Criminal Procedure Law 160.50 impacts the ultimate sentence, the error warrants appropriate correction. Such is the case here, where the court imposed on defendant a higher sentence than promised at his plea, based on the finding that the unsealed trial record, which the court mistakenly believed it could consider, established defendant's violation of a pre-sentence condition of his plea. The court wrote, Before sentencing, defendant was arrested and prosecuted for a crime allegedly committed after entering his plea. At defendant's request, the sentencing court agreed to adjourn defendant's sentencing pending resolution of the matter. The jury acquitted defendant of the new charge, and the official record, including the trial transcript, was sealed in accordance with Criminal Procedure Law Section 160.50. The day following that acquittal, the prosecutor informed the court, which had accepted defendant's criminal possession plea, that the people would be requesting an enhanced sentence on the criminal possession conviction because defendant violated a pre-sentence condition of the plea by engaging in criminal conduct during the sentencing adjournment, as made clear by defendant's trial testimony in the other case. The prosecutor then moved to unseal the records in the prior criminal action, terminated by acquittal, arguing that justice requires unsealing because the trial testimony was relevant to defendant's request to be sentenced under the terms of his plea, and the court granted the motion. So again, that was found to be reversible error. Next is People v. Carlos, M.A., on page 23. It's another sentencing case involving a youthful offender. Second Department, reversing county court, held defendant should have been accorded youthful offender status despite the armed felony conviction. The court wrote, as the defendant was convicted of an armed felony, and it cites Criminal Procedure Law Section 1.20, Subdivision 41, he was eligible to have his conviction replaced with a youthful offender adjudication only if there were mitigating circumstances that bore directly upon the manner in which the crime was committed, citing Criminal Procedure Law Section 720.10, Subdivision 3, Roman numeral 1. Mitigating circumstances include factors directly flowing from and relating to the defendant's personal conduct while committing the crime, but generally do not include the defendant's age, background, criminal history, and drug habit. Here, while there is no question that the defendant stands convicted of a serious crime, no physical harm or injury resulted to the complainant from the incident, and the defendant was an eligible youth under Criminal Procedure Law Section 720.10, Subdivision 2, for purposes of youthful offender treatment. Moreover, in the exercise of our discretion, we determined that the defendant should be granted youthful offender treatment. Next is People v. Francis on page 24. Court of Appeals case dealing with an interesting issue where the defendant claimed his sentences had been illegally lenient in an attempt to negate some prior convictions. The Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Garcia, held that the defendant may not appeal from an illegally lenient sentence because the sentence did not adversely affect the defendant. The defendant was attempting to have prior sentences declared illegal to avoid a subsequent persistent felony offender classification. Defendant had used aliases and had been given illegally lenient sentences because the sentencing court was unaware of the prior convictions. The court wrote, when a defendant moves to vacate his sentence on the ground that it is illegally lenient, denial of such a motion is not reviewable because any purported error or defect in the criminal court proceedings has not adversely affected the defendant, citing Criminal Procedure Law Section 470.15, Subdivision 1. Accordingly, we affirm, defendant's criminal history consists of at least four felony convictions over a 15-year period. During this time, it appears that he repeatedly attempted to conceal that history, primarily through the use of aliases. To a remarkable degree, though a recidivist, he avoided enhanced punishment required by statute. Instead, he obtained sentences that were illegally lenient given his actual status as a predicate felon. However, in 1997, the court, based on the evidence of defendant's prior convictions, sentenced him to a term of 23 years to life in prison as a persistent violent felony offender, citing Penal Law Section 70.08. Since then, by direct appeal and collateral attack, defendant has tried to overturn the illegally lenient sentences that were previously imposed based on his incomplete criminal history, with the ultimate goal of invalidating his 1997 persistent violent felony offender sentence. Next is People versus McClinton on page 25, another sentencing case, this time involving the impropriety of consecutive sentences. Second Department held the trial evidence did not support consecutive sentences for criminal possession of a weapon and murder. The court wrote, "We agree with the defendant that the sentencing court could not lawfully direct that the sentence imposed upon one of the convictions of criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree run consecutive to the sentence imposed upon the conviction of murder in the second degree. As the defendant correctly contends, it is impossible, based on the indictment or the trial court's charge, to determine whether the act that formed the basis of the jury's verdict on the criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree counts was not the basis for its conviction on the murder in the second degree count. Therefore, the people have failed to meet their burden of proving the validity of consecutive sentences." Next is Matter of Motzel on pages 25 and 26, another sentencing case, this time dealing with shock incarceration and the role of the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. The Third Department determined the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision, DOCS, did not have the authority to find the petitioner was not eligible for the shock incarceration based upon his drug-related prison disciplinary history. Although the appeal was moot because petitioner had completed the program, the appeal was heard as an exception to the mootness doctrine because the scenario is likely to recur. The court wrote, "Once an inmate has been judicially ordered into the program, DOCS participation under Penal Law Section 60.04 Subdivision 7 is expressly limited to its administration of the program, that is, the completion, discipline, and removal of an inmate from the program. If the legislature intended DOCS to have administrative discretion as to the eligibility criteria, it could have said so." Next is People v. Diaz, pages 26 and 27, Court of Appeals case dealing with the Sex Offender Registration Act. The Court of Appeals held documentary evidence of reliable hearsay was sufficient for a finding defendant used violence to coerce the child victim in this course of sexual conduct against a child case. Therefore, defendant was properly adjudicated a level 2 risk of reoffense. The court wrote, "At a SORA hearing conducted as defendant was nearing completion of his prison sentence, he was adjudicated a level 2 risk of reoffense due in part to the assessment of 10 points under risk factor 1, use of violence. That finding was based on information in the pre-sentence investigation, that's the PSI, prepared in connection with the offense, stating that on one or more occasions he used physical force to coerce the victim into cooperation. Information also intended in the case included in the case summary prepared by the Board of Examiners of Sex Offenders. Defendant argues that this evidence was insufficient to supply evidence of use of violence because it constituted hearsay and did not more specifically describe his conduct. SORA adjudications by design are typically based on documentary evidence under the statute's reliable hearsay standard. Case summaries and PSI reports meet that standard, meaning they can provide sufficient evidence to support the imposition of points. PSI reports are prepared by probation officers who investigate the circumstances surrounding the commission of the offense. Defendant's record of delinquency or criminality, family situation and social, employment, economic, educational, and personal history, analyzing that data to provide a sentencing recommendation. Citing Criminal Procedure Law Section 390.30, Subdivision 1. Their primary function is to assist the criminal court in determining the appropriate sentence for the particular defendant based on the specific offense. defendants have a right to review the report prior to sentencing, citing Criminal Procedure Law 390.50, Subdivision 2A, and may challenge the accuracy of any facts contained therein at that time, citing Criminal Procedure Law 400.10. Because there is record support for the imposition of points under Risk Factor 1, there is no basis to disturb the Appellate Division order. Next is Matter of State of New York versus Marcello A. It's another sex offender case, this time dealing with civil commitment. The Second Department, affirming the finding that appellant sex offender required civil management, found that the expert's name was Charter, the expert's testimony about appellant's voyeuristic disorder diagnosis should not have been credited. The Second Department further held the Fry hearing demonstrated that the Hare Psychopathies Checklist Revised, that's PCL-R, is widely accepted and used in the psychological and psychiatric communities. The court wrote, "We agree with the appellant that Charter's testimony regarding her diagnosis of a voyeuristic disorder should not have been credited. Charter admitted that her diagnosis of a voyeuristic disorder was inconsistent with the diagnostic criteria contained in Section 302.82 of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. Although her decision to apply an alternative definition of voyeuristic disorder does not necessarily render this diagnosis insufficient to establish a mental abnormality, Charter failed to clearly set forth the diagnostic criteria that she utilized in diagnosing the appellant under this alternative definition of voyeuristic disorder, and she otherwise failed to explain the basis of her opinion that certain conduct attributed to the appellant was voyeuristic, thus rendering such testimony conclusory. The evidence adduced at the Fry hearing demonstrated that the PCL-R has enjoyed long and widespread use within the psychological and psychiatric communities as a tool to measure psychopathy. Although there was evidence indicating that the PCL-R was not designed to function as a direct and standalone test of whether an individual has a mental abnormality within the meaning of the statute, expert testimony established that it could nevertheless contribute to an assessment of the presence of mental abnormality. So again, in this case, the Second Department determined the expert's testimony about a voyeuristic disorder, which was not recognized in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, was conclusory and should not have been admitted, but the finding that appellant sex offender required civil management was affirmed. Next is People versus Inab on pages 29 and 30. It's a speedy trial case. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Chambers, held the 28-year pre-indictment delay in this murder case did not violate defendant's due process rights. Defendant was arrested in 2008 and his DNA profile was obtained. He had been a suspect in the 1984 murder, and the blood evidence from the murder was linked to the defendant. The court wrote, "The pre-indictment delay of more than 28 years was undoubtedly extraordinary, a fact that weighs in favor of the defendant. However, under the circumstances, the people met their burden of demonstrating good cause for the delay. The record of the Singer hearing supports the hearing court's determination that the people acted in good faith in deferring commencement of the prosecution until after they were able to match the defendant's DNA profile with the one found on some of the blood-stained items recovered from the crime scene." Well, the defendant correctly points out that DNA testing of the crime scene evidence could have been performed years earlier. There's nothing to suggest that such tests would have yielded any meaningful information, as the defendant's own DNA profile was not available to investigators for comparative purposes until it was entered in March of 2008. Nor are we persuaded by the defendant's contention that the people could have sought a court order compelling the defendant to produce a DNA sample for analysis before 2008. considering that the outcome of such a proceeding under the particular facts of this case would be very difficult to predict, we are loath to saddle the people with an affirmative duty to embark upon a course that could ultimately prove unsuccessful and possibly jeopardize an ongoing investigation. Next is People v. Clark on page 30, another speedy trial case. Second Department, remitting the matter for a hearing, held defendant should have been afforded a hearing on his motion to dismiss for a speedy trial violation. Defendant was charged with damaging his wife's computer in a domestic incident, and the charge was not brought for 22 months. The court wrote, under the circumstances, which included a delay of approximately 22 months from the time of the incident to the filing of the indictment and arraignment, the people's failure on the record to establish a good faith legitimate reason for the delay, and the defendant's claim of prejudice, the county court should have conducted a hearing before determining that the delay in prosecution was not in violation of the defendant's due process rights. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this February 2020 criminal law update CLE. The verification code is speedy trial. Again, the verification code for this February 2020 criminal law update CLE is speedy trial. Next is People v. Nazario, which is on page 31. It deals with a street stop. Fourth Department affirmed Supreme Court's ruling that the officer did not have a sufficient basis for detaining the defendant on the street, searching defendant's bag, and transporting defendant to the burglary scene. The court wrote, the evidence at the suppression hearing established that the officer who initiated the encounter with defendant was responding to a radio dispatch of a burglary in progress. Because other officers were already at the scene of the burglary when he arrived, the officer canvassed the nearby area in his patrol car. Shortly thereafter, the officer noticed defendant three blocks from the burglary scene, walking alone and carrying a bag and a cell phone. Although the officer justified the search of defendant's bag as a check for weapons, the record does not reflect that at any time during the encounter, the officer reasonably suspected the defendant was armed and posed a threat to his safety. Further, all the officer could definitively recall of the initial radio dispatch reporting the burglary in progress was that it described the suspect as a male, although the officer also testified that the dispatch might have identified the suspect as Hispanic and wearing a dark hooded sweatshirt. The vague description of the suspect provided by the radio dispatch, as recounted by the officer at the suppression hearing, did not provide the officer with the requisite reasonable suspicion to effect what was at least a forcible detention of defendant and to transport him to take part in a show-up identification. The final case is People v. Rivera on page 32. It has to do with closing the courtroom to relatives. First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the trial court should not have excluded defendant's family members from the trial during the testimony of the undercover officers. The court wrote, following a Hinton hearing at which there was no testimony that defendant or any member of his family threatened or otherwise posed a threat to either of the two testifying undercover officers, defense counsel requested that family members be permitted to attend the officer's trial testimony. Although the prosecutor made no argument in opposition to this application, the court denied it without making any supporting findings. This was error. An order of closure that does not make an exception for family members will be considered overbroad unless the prosecution can show specific reasons why the family members must be excluded. So that concludes this February 2020 Criminal Law Update CLE.